Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Wednesday, July the 4th. Happy 4th of July. A factory worker is fired because her boss dislikes a political bumper sticker that she has put on her car. A stockbroker resigns because his employer frowns on his off-work political activities. A manager gets the axe after publishing an online essay about homosexuality. A flight attendant is grounded because her airline disapproves of her personal blog. Just some examples of workers who did not apparently have a right to free speech in the workplace. They are outlined in the new book, Speechless, The Erosion of Free Expression in the American Workplace. We will wonder this hour if you think it should be legal to fire people for things they say or write or display, even if it has nothing to do with a job or a workplace. Our guest this hour says that freedom of speech in the workplace is excessively and needlessly limited. And that is hurting our democracy and our society in general. We wonder if you agree or not. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. We welcome you to speak out. Are you free to speak your mind or your politics at your workplace? 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. Bruce Berry is a professor of management and sociology at Vanderbilt University, president of the American Civil Liberties Union of Tennessee, author of Speechless, The Erosion of Free Expression in the American Workplace, and the website is speechlessthebook.com. And he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning to you, and happy 4th of July.
Yeah, happy 4th of July, an appropriate day, perhaps, to be talking about this. I think that a lot of people would be surprised that that this is a problem in America. Lots of people are getting fired just for what they say.
Well, I'm not going to argue that there's a sort of a rampant movement to fire people for speech going on everywhere. I think that when it does happen, though, it's important. But yes, I think that's right, Joy, that a lot of people don't realize the limits of their rights to free speech, the limits of the First Amendment. People, I think we grow up thinking that the First Amendment and free speech are something natural, something that governs all of society in which we live. But there are clear limits created by law and also in the workplace by how managers and employers act. And a major point of my book is to try and explain what those limits are and to say why I think they're a problem.
Yeah, you don't think it's a problem if someone gets fired, for instance, for, causing disruptions with hateful, argumentative speech or, causing a disruption in the first place. You don't say there's unlimited free speech in the workplace.
Yeah, my book is not a manifesto for anything goes, and people should be able to say whatever they want, whenever they want, wherever they want, with respect to employment. That would probably make for an interesting workplace if they could. But I'm not advocating that. And, of course, employers should retain the right to police and do something about speech that is truly harassing or abusive or truly harmful to the interests of the employer, of the organization, or the business. And, that I'm not denying employers. I wouldn't deny employers the prerogative to do that. My concern is in other sorts of cases where they come down hard on speech that really doesn't have much to do with the work or the workplace or the job. And there are lots of gray areas between those two extremes, and I think the gray areas are where the tough cases lie and where some of the most interesting problems here lie.
Right. I mean, I was shocked to read this, that this woman pulls into her parking lot at her workplace, a factory, and she has a Carry for President bumper sticker on her car. And she gets fired for that?
Yeah, that took place in September 2004 in a small town in Alabama. She worked for a factory whose owner was a Republican who didn't like her John Kerry bumper sticker and told her something, I'm paraphrasing here, but told her you could work for me or you could work for John Kerry. And she refused to remove the bumper sticker and was fired. There was a kind of a nice outcome for her. This made news. People were sort of stunned at this, and it made national news. And the next day, John Kerry called her and offered her a job in his campaign. So that was kind of a nice outcome, although, of course, that didn't really work out in the long run.
How could that, I think a lot of us are wondering, how could that even be legal for a boss to say, remove that political bumper sticker from your car or you're fired?
Well, the explanation for why a boss can do that, and let me just throw in a quick caveat here, that if she had lived in certain places, certain parts of the country, she might have had some legal recourse against her employer. She was in Alabama. That's not a state, not one of the few states that had some political avenues, some legal avenues for doing it. So why is it legal? This example is an extreme one, and it does surprise people. Why is it legal for a boss to do that? And the answer lies partly in constitutional law. Very basic idea of our constitutional legal system is that the Bill of Rights in the Constitution only applies when the state acts. They call it the principle of state action in law. And so what this means is that when a private party, like a private employer, is the one infringing your rights, could be speech rights, could be due process rights, could be rights to bear arms, it could be rights, protection against illegal search and seizure. If it's a private party infringing your rights, basic idea of constitutional law says you don't have much, if any, recourse at all, because the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights applies when government acts. So that's half the explanation, constitutional law. The other half is our system of employment law in this country, which for most workers is the system we know as the employment at will system, which says that employers, generally speaking, can fire somebody for any reason, a good reason or a bad reason or no reason at all, and that system governs most workers in most situations. There are a number of exceptions to it. For example, if you have an employment contract that provides other provisions for when you can and can't be fired. But the basic employment at will system says you can be fired for just about any reason. So if you put those two together, constitutional law, which says the Bill of Rights won't apply on private property or when it's a private party, and employment law, which says you can be fired for just about any reason, you start to understand that if you live in a state where there really aren't some kinds of legal provisions or exceptions written in, you suddenly can see how the law easily gives employers this kind of power.
Yeah. Now, there are many more examples, and we'll talk about some of them. But why should it matter to me that this factory worker in Alabama was fired for her carry sticker?
Well, I think it surprises and offends people and should matter to you and matters to me, because the importance of the fact that this can happen goes beyond just, to me, the sort of culture of that particular workplace. If we had a law or a system of laws that said an employer couldn't do what that fellow did, that might make for a workplace that's a little less tyrannical, a little more liberated, and that would, I suppose, be a nice thing. But I think that the implications of this are much broader than just making workplaces a little less tyrannical or a little nicer in their culture. I think this matters because it has everything to do with how people live their lives as citizens, how they engage civically in their communities and politics and in everything else outside the workplace. I'm not going to argue that people are being fired rampantly for their bumper stickers. I teach at a graduate school of business. I would like to think my former students, now managers, are not spending a lot of their time roaming around parking lots looking for bumper stickers. But every time something like this does happen, or somebody's fired for their blog or for writing a letter to the editor or for whatever else they do expressively, it has a chilling effect on others. It sends a message that employers are attentive, they're watching, they're listening. They may be willing to use this rather vast power they have to do something about speech that alarms them or concerns them. And I think this sends a message to people that says your participation in society and community, your political and civic engagement are in tension with your job security. And I worry that this is one of the factors that contributes to what we see as kind of stagnant or declining civic participation in this country.
Yeah. I'm going to ask. There is an aerobics instructor that I have for an exercise class who accidentally started talking about something that strayed into a political arena and said, I was told I'm not supposed to talk politics at all during work time or during these classes. A tour guide on a trip I took once, same thing, can't talk politics. I was instructed not to talk about politics because political issues can get people fired up and mad at you. And I think that's maybe why some workplaces put some restrictions on people.
Yeah, that's certainly the case. And I think the two examples you've just given describe situations where the particular employee is in a direct customer service contact role, mm-hmm. and an employer is saying, gee, you probably ought to keep your politics out of your customer interactions, presumably for the obvious reason that you may interact with customers who hate your politics and therefore may take it out on their willingness to do business mm-hmm. with my aerobic studio or right. my tour company or whatever. I don't think that those are necessarily unreasonable requests by employers as guidelines for how somebody in a frontline customer service role should act. And I'm not sure that's really the issue there, although I would be concerned if a sort of a mild bit of political conversation crept into that kind of customer interaction and the employer imposed the sort of workplace equivalent of capital punishment for it and fired the person on the spot. I would think that would be perhaps a punishment that doesn't fit the crime. But I certainly understand and am tolerant of that kind of a guideline for somebody in a customer service role.
We're talking with Bruce Barry, author of Speechless, The Erosion of Free Expression in the American Workplace, talking about how he says that the freedom of speech in the workplace is excessively and needlessly limited, and that it can have a chilling effect on the exercise of free speech, both on and off the job, which hurts our civic duties, our the health of our democracy. We welcome your thoughts and questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Hope you stay with us on this 4th of July. Ben Marins is in between 4 and 6 this afternoon. Did you know that George Washington did not sign the Declaration of Independence? Do you know who did? After 5, Ben's guest has an entertaining refresher course on the history of America's birthday. That's coming up after 5 o'clock. We're talking with the author of Speechless, The Erosion of Free Expression in the American Workplace, Bruce Barry, who is also a professor of management and sociology at Vanderbilt University. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We welcome your questions for him, maybe your examples of your own freedom of speech being limited in the workplace, or maybe your thoughts that this is appropriate, that an employer can tell, say, an employee to not have a carry for president bumper sticker on her car. Victor in Milwaukee, hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, Joyce. Happy holiday. Happy holiday to your guest.
Mm-hmm, you Thank too. You.
I would understand it. I would err on the fact that I would not want, if I was a supervisor, and I am in supervisory positions in the military and in the civilian world because I'm a Navy reservist, I would discourage it for that one reason, to prevent arguments and dissension and everything. Because if you're an employer, you got somebody who supports the Greens versus somebody who supports the Libertarians at each other's throat, there's no productivity. I wouldn't personally fire anybody because of their political beliefs. I mean, that's almost extremism, and I think that person has some personal issues, but I would discourage it. And me personally, I've worked for jobs, and I just kept my political views neutral on the job because I don't want it to affect my promotion or my job security. So I just play it safe and just kept it neutral.
Mm-hmm. Professor Barry?
Well, I'm sympathetic with Victor's point that you know, political or other kinds of conversations at work that have nothing to do with work could get out of hand, and employers have an interest in, you know, efficiency and stability and all that. My problem, though, is that I think that sort of overlooks the real world of real people in real jobs. And, you know, work is where people live out their lives. In most jobs, they're not automatons who sit in silence with no interaction. You know, for a lot of people, it's where adults actually form connections with other adults. It may be for busy people with the you know, work and family and everything else, the one place where they actually have these kinds of interactions. And as a result, it's not just where people sort of create their work identities and their professional selves. It's also where people form their political identities, their community selves, if you will. And so, while I think it's a nice idea to sort of sweep broadly and say, well, we'll have none of this at work. You do your speech after work on your own time. I think that just sort of overlooks the reality of how people really actually exist and interact. Let me add one other point to this, that we can talk about the division between work and off work, mm-hmm. and we've been using some of the examples that we've been talking about involve people talking about politics and things that clearly don't have much to do with their job directly. But the point I want to make, Joy, is that for a lot of people, the boundary between work and off work is not so clear. This is a result of, you know, changes in technology, changes in the nature of work, changes in how people live their work-life balance. And as a result, it isn't necessarily quite so clear what is on work and what is off work, what topics are on work and off work. And so there are really hazy boundaries and a lot of gray areas where employers can choose to be tolerant and reasonable, or they can choose to be intolerant and unforgiving, or perhaps some combination of that. And I'm concerned about those tough calls in gray areas.
Yeah, and there's the at work speech, and there's what you do on your own time out of the office. You have examples of a stockbroker resigns. It says he wasn't fired, but resigns because his employer frowns on his off-work political activities.
I really like that example. That was a guy in Houston, Texas in the late mm-hmm. 90s who was involved in his community off work as not just a supporter, but actually a leader of a movement to pass a citywide ballot initiative. Happened to be something that the mayor of Houston didn't like, and he happened to be a stockbroker for a firm that did a lot of underwriting business with the city of Houston. So the story goes, from his point of view, the mayor told the stockbroker brokerage house, you know, shut this guy down, and he was pressured to resign, is his side of the story. And I like that example because it's a perfect example of what I'm talking about when I talk about how employer restrictions on speech can really chill civic engagement and engagement in community. I mean, here's a case where a guy was doing what we like to think people mm-hmm. do, getting active in their community as a leader off work, away from the job, and yet this essentially caused him to lose his job, and I think that really illustrates the problem.
Yeah.
And also it illustrates, let me add one other thing, it illustrates that gray area between work and non-work, because although this ballot initiative didn't have anything to do probably with his day-to-day job as a stockbroker, it was an issue, it had to do with affirmative action, it was an issue where his employer had an interest, and so suddenly it wasn't quite totally off work, unrelated to job and employment.
Yeah, and then there's this case where apparently a workplace wanted its employees to attend or participate in a Gulf War celebration. It was a defense contractor, and a worker refused to and got canned.
There's a number of examples. Yeah, that occurred in mm-hmm. Connecticut in the early 90s after the first Gulf War. It was a defense contractor, a helicopter factory, and the fellow didn't want to cheerfully participate in the post-war celebration. But that's an example that's emblematic of a set of them that involve what we could sort of group as compelled speech, the idea that employers often have a preferred point of view. And the cases we've been talking about previously had to do with the idea of an employee having a different point of view and maybe the employer not liking it so much. But here we're talking about situations where the employer actually wants employees to adhere to or at least exhibit some sort of expressive activity that suggests that they buy into some preferred point of view. This is a very, I think, a very current and real situation. Think about the presidential campaign, the endless presidential campaign already mm-hmm. underway, where it's not uncommon for candidates to make appearances at corporations, at factories, give speeches. Employers will typically expect their employees to turn out cheerfully and enthusiastically. There are some cases where employers have tried to get employees to participate in lobbying efforts or to go to off-work political events in support of a candidate. And here are cases where employers are using this power that they have to compel expression, to compel a point of view from their employees. And again, I think that's wrong, and I think it's inappropriate that employers have the power to hold your job over your head in trying to compel that sort of speech.
Our guest is Bruce Berry. He is author of Speechless, The Erosion of Free Expression in the American Workplace. And our next caller is Dave in Menominee, Michigan. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Well, I've worked in union shops, mills, and factories from the 70s and watched everything deteriorate and until it was an at-will workplace. And I can tell you, first of all, is the atmosphere. When you work in a union shop, you don't have to worry about, you know, other people. In an at-will atmosphere, there are going to be, in all the shops that I worked in that were at-will, people that are going to try to point out everything wrong with everybody else in attempt to keep themselves a job. And the atmosphere is always a backstabbing atmosphere in an at-will workplace. And the the main reason for the at-will is behind insurance companies. Whenever anyone was injured in the mill, if you became injured, you were going to be fired. That was known. If somebody became injured, everybody got together and thought, oh, man, that's too bad. They're going to be fired. Yeah. And they were.
Yeah. It was straying a little bit from the free speech in the workplace issue with that. But what about unions and whether or not we're seeing more of this because we're seeing fewer unions, Bruce Berry? Or is there
Absolutely. And I'm very glad that Dave brought up the union or organized labor situation, because that's an important piece of this. I mentioned earlier on that this basic idea of at-will employment carries lots of exceptions. For example, employment contracts. Certainly a union collective bargaining contract is an important exception to employment at will, in the sense that it does provide some protections, although clearly, as Dave is pointing out, those protections often are not quite what some people think they are in many situations. I don't know if I'd quite agree with him that the at-will world is a world of backstabbing at all corners and in all situations. But it is important, the idea that the decline in private sector unionization in this country, now under 10%, really does mean fewer workers have those kinds of protections. A union contract, a collective bargaining contract, doesn't bring free speech protections necessarily explicitly, but what it does bring is the thing that really matters underlying all this, which is it brings at least a little bit of a right to due process before you lose your job, a right to file a grievance typically and to have it heard in some, in, at least in theory, procedurally fair way. You won't necessarily win your case. But the typical at-will employee has no due process right in employment. So if your employer does fire you for some silly reason, you have no means to challenge it in this country, something that is, by the way, uniquely American, we might say, on the 4th of July. Most countries that we like to compare ourselves to, call them Western-style industrial democracies, most of them have a system of employment law that at least guarantees some right against being fired without just cause and some due process right to challenge a termination.
It's kind of a catch-22, too. Employers aren't supposed to fire people for wanting to organize a union or for speaking out in favor of a union, but if it's an at-will place, they could fire them for something else.
Well, that's right. And when you talk about organizing a union, that is before a union exists, the National Labor Relations Act, which is the main law that governs that sort of thing, does have written into it what appears to be a pretty broad-based free speech protection in the pursuit of union organizing. But there have been lots of conflicts over how far the reach of that is, how much speech that might lead to organizing a union and trying to organize a union is really allowed. And we clearly have had in recent years a political climate in this country that's not very friendly to the employee side of that equation.
Mike in Madison is with us now. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I just thought I'd give an example. I recently retired from the State Department of Natural Resources, and for the last several years, I had an order over myself that said I could not talk to other coworkers or the public, for that matter, on issues related to global warming or transportation, or I'd be disciplined appropriately, whatever that meant. Well, I knew what it meant, but because I had been reassigned once before for doing that very thing, but I felt really crushed by that whole philosophy.
That's a terrific example, and it invites us to first of all talk a little bit about the difference between you worked for the state, Mike, right?
I did.
Yes, and that invites us certainly to talk about the difference between working in the public sector versus the private sector. In the public sector, you know, I said at the sort of start of the interview that constitutional law says, generally speaking, that free speech rights and the Bill of Rights don't apply when it's a private party infringing your speech. If you're a government worker like Mike, your employer is the government. So the government has fewer less discretion to shut down employee speech because, in theory, the Bill of Rights applies. The First Amendment applies in the public sector workplace. But, and there's a big but here, there's been a number of legal cases over the years, several of which have reached the Supreme Court over the last three or four decades, on this particular issue, public employee speech in the workplace or free from punishment by your employer. And what the doctrine that the Supreme Court has carved out on this says the following. Your speech as a public employee is protected if it's on a matter of what they call public concern, a matter of sort of broad public interest. But even then, it may not be protected unless it can pass a second test, which is if the employer says your speech would be unduly harmful to the efficiency of the government agency or to the workplace harmony within that agency, then the employer can make a case that your speech shouldn't be protected, even though it is on a matter of public interest. And so what happens with public employees like Mike is, if it comes to a lawsuit, a court has to weigh this balance between the employee's free speech right and the employer's claim that this harms the agency. Mike's example sounds like a very interesting one, because speaking out on things like global climate change, clearly a matter of public interest. His employer saying, you can't do this. Certainly, most people, including myself, I would defend the right of your employer, the Department of Natural Resources, to say, you can't speak for us. You're not in a spokesperson's role, so you can't represent your opinion as the position of the department. That's, to me, a fair restriction. But to say that you can't express your own opinions on your own time about global climate change or else you'll lose your job strikes me as the sort of situation that really raises legal questions. Mm-hmm. And if it came to a lawsuit and the department were in there saying, well, this harms our agency for Mike to say this, and this harms the efficiency of what the services we're delivering and the harmony of the workplace, I'd like to see a judge really apply a very high level of scrutiny to that kind of employer claim, because my concern is that judges too often take those kinds of employer claims about harm a little bit too easily and literally without exploring them with enough scrutiny. That's kind of a long answer, but it's a great example.
Mike, I am familiar with I think I know who you are just from some stories in the news that had occurred involving you speaking out on these various issues. Are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, and do you have a follow-up? Or?
Well, yeah, related to the position of the agency thinking that you're speaking for them.
Right.
I was told in fairly uncertain terms that even when I don't speak for them, if I qualify myself, that I'm still representing the department because I'm employed by them, and so people connect mm-hmm. me with them even if I say this is just my position.
See, my opinion is that kind of argument by an employer is very alarming, because it's all too easy to make. It's all too easy for an employer, public or private, to say, well, heck, you work for us, and so you live your entire life as representing us, 24/7, 365. Anything you say could be connected to us, even when you say it isn't. And a problem is that employees don't necessarily control their identities, their professional identities. Take the stockbroker in Texas, private sector, similar idea, speaking out on an issue of public interest, and the employer saying, you can't represent your views as those of us. Not only can't you represent them as being our view, but they shouldn't be taken that way, even if you're not trying to represent it that way. And so you could say, if you're speaking out on global warming or on affirmative action, whatever the topic is, you could say to a reporter, well, I'm not going to tell you who my employer is. I'm just a concerned citizen here. But if a reporter finds out who your employer is, just like if they find out what your age is, I mean, anybody who makes the news, that's, they'll report how old you are, who you work for, what you do. They'll do that with or without your permission, and as they have a First Amendment right to. And so you don't necessarily control that connection between you or your employer. And this is why I'm very concerned that when these cases do, if they come to court, that judges and juries scrutinize very carefully this employer claim that what you say affects us and represents us, whether you mean it to or not. I think that can easily be regarded in many situations as a nonsense claim, but yet it's one that courts often defer to, and that's, I think, part of the problem.
Yeah. Mike, I'm going to have Christina Taylor, our on-air producer, get some contact information for you, because now that you're not with the DNR anymore, maybe you'd like to talk on the air a little bit more about your views on climate change and other things. Thanks for calling in. Next is, well, before I go to another call, let me remind listeners that we are talking with Bruce Barry, Speechless, the author of the book Speechless, The Erosion of Free Expression in the American Workplace, 1-800-642-1234. If you would like to join in with a question or maybe an example of how your free speech rights are being eroded in the workplace, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up, Veronica Rickard in for Kathleen Dunn. Public embarrassment, unfortunate decisions, awkward blunders are swept under the carpet, except when they happen to the President of the United States, according to Veronica's guest, coming up after 9 o'clock. We're talking about our freedom of speech in the workplace and outside of the workplace, for that matter, talking with the author of Speechless, The Erosion of Free Expression in the American Workplace. Bruce Barry is a professor of management and sociology at Vanderbilt University. You can also check out more about this book on the website, speechlessthebook.com. Kelsey in Green Bay is with us next. Hi, you're on the air.
Thanks for having me on the air. I have a friend, this is not my personal case, but I have a friend who works at Perkins, and he and I are both big advocates for gay rights. And he is a cook at Perkins, and he's actually not even allowed to wear a rainbow ribbon at work.
Yeah, what about that, Bruce Berry?
Well, I love these calls where I have a friend, yes, okay. I mean, a private sector employer can say what you can and can't wear and what messages you can and cannot wear when you're at work and on the job. So, legally, there's no close call here. It's clearly something within the province of private employers. Personally, though, I think it's precisely the kind of silly overreaction that I worry about. You know, my guess is that if we looked at how people actually dress or the adornments they wear, we might find different forms of expression, and here you have an employer singling out one particular one and not necessarily applying an even standard. But now, having said that, though, let me add that this can easily descend into some difficult questions, right? Mm-hmm. You could say at your workplace, let's say it's a kind of a setting where people wear T-shirts with messages on them, and, you know, is it okay for somebody to wear a T-shirt with the name of a band that they like, you know, with the Rolling Stones on it? And you say, fine. Mm-hmm. Well, is it okay to wear a T-shirt that says Hillary 08 or Romney 08? And you might say, well, that's getting political, but, well, maybe okay. Well, what happens if you start having people wearing T-shirts with messages about very controversial issues, abortion, mm-hmm. the war, I don't know, stem cell research, name your issue. And then how far will you go? And it goes back to the earlier caller, Victor, who said he wanted to leave, you know, arguments out of the workplace because this will descend into non-productivity. And that's a fair concern. So if you're going to allow employees to express themselves on the job with messages that are artistic, political, whatever, as an employer, you have to be wary of the fact that it can easily descend into some tough areas of provocative speech, and how provocative will you let the speech go? Personally, I wish employers wouldn't respond to that dilemma, would not respond to the dilemma by saying, well, I'll just ban all speech, only T-shirts with no messages, because to me that stifles people's self-expression, who they are. I'd rather see employers try to wrestle with where to draw the line, difficult as that may be.
Yeah, but you don't want the restaurant to say, you know what, you can wear, I don't know, yellow ribbons to support our troops, but you can't wear the pink ribbon to support gay rights.
Which a private employer can.
I know, yeah,
a public sector employer or anything in the public sector, that would be a case of what First Amendment lawyer types call viewpoint discrimination, and that would really fall into a legally perilous area for a government employer. But yes, sadly, in my mind, a private sector employer can pick and choose among the messages they're willing to allow.
Yeah, the talk about this manager who got fired after publishing an online essay about homosexuality.
That's a guy who liked to write these online kind of op-ed kinds of mm-hmm. things for some right-wing online publications, and he worked for an insurance company in the Midwest, and he the essay you referred to was an anti-homosexuality screed. The insurance company fired him. And what's interesting about that case is when he filed a lawsuit, private sector employee expressing opinions, you wouldn't expect there to be any lawsuit potential, but there was. But he claimed that religious expression was at stake, that he was expressing religiously based views about homosexuality. And that's important because, of course, our civil rights laws do say that one thing you can't fire people for is their matters related to race, religion, gender, age, disability, and so forth. So here was a case where he said, you know, you're not firing me for my off-work political speech, you're firing me for my religious expression, and so perhaps I have a civil rights claim. And in fact, he and the insurance company did settle out of court, signaling to me that the employer was, you know, had its doubts about whether it could prevail. Actually, you know, thought that he might have a legitimate claim there, and that illustrates another difficult area, which is where employers have to struggle with religious expression and potentially religious harassment, to the extent that some employees might regard the messages that others state as, in some sense, harassing, sexual harassment, sexual orientation harassment, racial harassment, and so forth.
Our next caller is Jean in Oshkosh. Hi, Jean.
Happy Independence Day, Joy.
Yes,
and
you
Professor
too.
Barry.
And same to you.
Ironically, the previous caller said he likes to play it safe. We would not be celebrating Independence Day had we played it safe.
Well said.
I'm a member of ACLU, despite the fact that I do take issue on some of the stands they take. However, my basic question to you, and this is something that has bothered me a long time, I'm sure I can come up with instances in the workplace, but in general, is free speech resource dependent? What I'm asking is, we just, within the last week, the Supreme Court threw out part of McCain-Feingold, which had to do with the issue ads prior to or in proximity to an election. And we have seen instances where people with great financial resources are able to run ads that can't be answered by candidates or their forces. And so basically my question is, can we talk if we have the funds to talk?
Well, I think that's a great question. And you know, unfortunately, from my perspective, the answer is that the modern Supreme Court is not particularly sensitive to or concerned with the idea that, in a sense, free speech rights can be, or at least the ability to exercise those rights, can be resource-dependent. Right, in the area of campaign finance, ever since the Buckley decision in the 1970s, the court has said you can spend your own money as a political candidate as much of it as you want. It has said that the Congress and legislatures can put some reasonable restrictions on contributions, but it hasn't been especially sympathetic to the idea that rules about how free speech is regulated may affect who can speak and what kind of resources are necessary to do so. This is not unrelated, of Joy, I will add quickly, to the workplace context that we're talking about, because another thing that courts have done over the past 20, 30, 40, 30 years is carved out free speech rights for corporations, for private employers. And so, you know, as we were talking earlier about the idea that an employer says to an employee, we don't want your speech to be connected to us, and we expect you to keep your speech separate and to prevent it ever from anybody inferring that your speech is our speech. But companies don't have that problem, right? If my employer speaks out, it's under no obligation, nor can I force it to take any steps to ensure that its speech is not connected with me, an employee. And so there's a kind of a workplace example of the idea that the power is imbalanced here. The corporation's speech is constitutionally protected now. The employee's speech is not constitutionally protected from being punished by one's employer, a real imbalance of power, the kind of resource dependence idea that Gene was talking about.
It might be getting a little bit off subject, but I want to, it's certainly related. We had a program a while back, quite a while back, in fact, about a movement that was going on with an advocate of this movement to bring politics into the workplace, to have the employer invite, say, political candidates or people perhaps on the employer's side of an issue, saying that this was a fine thing to get the workplace involved with these political issues that matter to that workplace.
I think it's a fine thing when it's not coercive. Mm-hmm. It's been in the news recently that Google out in California, in Mountain View, has been hosting a veritable parade of presidential candidates. It seems like almost a ring-kissing enterprise where they all have to go and speak before Google employees. And as long as, I think the idea of politicizing the workplace, that is of saying to people, you don't have to give up your life of politics and civic engagement during your work time, and that we celebrate and encourage that sort of thing. We'll even you know, that we hear about employers having experimenting with things like book events where authors come in and talk to employees. I mean, the idea that work can be a place for enlightenment, I think, is a wonderful idea, as long as employers are not using it to bludgeon workers with a preferred point of view. Mm-hmm. And holding out job security as this kind of sort of Damocles over people if they don't enthusiastically buy into, or at least pretend to buy into, that preferred point of view. That's the risk, but I love the sentiment, sure.
Next, we go to Tom in Elburn, Illinois. Hi, you're on the air.
Joy, can you ask your guest, well, first of all, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, you can ask him. That's good.
To what extent has your guest investigated the Patriot Act in relation to free speech in the workplace?
Is that involved at all, Professor Barry?
Well, it doesn't get a mention in the book. You won't find Patriot Act in the index, but it is a fascinating question. If you're still on the line, Tom, could you elaborate a bit?
Yes.
Yes, go ahead.
Elaborate a bit on your thinking about this.
As an example, I'm thinking about this situation that happened in Massachusetts with the librarian who
sure.
was subpoenaed by the federal government in relation to obtaining records on people who were checking out certain types of books and that type of investigation.
I guess that steers a little bit away from speech. It's certainly, to me personally, it won't probably surprise you to learn, alarming. We could call it, I suppose, a form of compelled speech, but, you know, being subpoenaed to testify, I mean, if a librarian, let's use a different example other than the Patriot Act, if a librarian witnesses a crime in the library and is subpoenaed to come to court and say what he or she saw, and, you know, I wouldn't call that compelled workplace speech. I'd call that, you know, responding to legal obligations. The Patriot Act really is kind of the same thing, although you or I might disagree with the fact that Patriot Act provision exists and the fact that the government can compel a librarian to provide that information. But it is kind of in the same category, and I think it moves a little bit away from the kind of workplace speech I'm mostly talking about.
Yeah, I mean, it would relate, not the Patriot Act at all, but let's say a boss sees me walk in, you know, my workplace with a book under my arm that I'm going to read during the lunch hour while I sit at my desk. That's, I don't know, it's the Communist Manifesto, and he doesn't think I should be reading that at my desk during my lunch hour.
So you're saying you've been reading the Communist Manifesto?
No, I made that up.
I
made that up. But, I mean, that's the kind of, I'm just making this example up. A boss could presumably fire me for doing that if
You bet. And let me twist that example a little bit, because it's not as far-fetched. I mean, the idea that your boss would spy on you, the reading material under your arm, well, maybe not. But increasingly, people do their reading, get their information online. And if you take a break, you take a lunch break, most employers are pretty reasonable. They say, oh, we don't mind some recreational web surfing that's not interfering with your job. But because you're doing it on your employer's network, whether you're going to Newsweek.com or reading the Weekly Standard or The Nation or The American Prospect online, suddenly this is information available to your employer. I'm not going to argue that most employers are trolling for your reading material, but they can, and some perhaps do, and they can act on it if they wish.
Yeah. In the case where my free speech or my political speech does differ with the philosophy of my workplace, another made-up example, maybe I work for a right-to-life organization because, you know, I'm good at PR or something, but I'm attending rallies for the pro-choice group because that's really where my political beliefs are. There's nothing wrong with my employer firing me because I'm doing that, is there?
Well, unfortunately, well, I think there's plenty wrong with it. Unfortunately, the law allows them to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Why
do you think there's something wrong with that?
Well, I think that political opinions on public affairs should be essentially a protected category against employment discrimination, unless the employer can demonstrate that it really is legitimately related to the business or the form in which you're doing your expression is legitimately interfering with the business. You know, imagine this. Imagine if our civil rights law, which says that employment discrimination is illegal on the basis of race and religion and sex and age and such. Imagine, and national origin, imagine if you added to that list political opinion. Would that be an outlandish thing to do? There's actually a convention of the International Labor Organization that lists by this international convention, the things that are inappropriate bases for discrimination, and it includes political opinion on that list along with race and religion and sex. 160 countries have signed on to that convention. The United States is not one of them.
Yeah. Should a public radio host be limited in his or her free speech? There are public radio stations that do say, I just read about one, and where someone was let go. Because
of their off-work speech?
No, on-work, on-radio speech, in fact. And a little bit of off-work, but it's on-radio speeches in particular. Not supposed to take stands on issues, supposed to remain neutral on issues. And this person apparently wouldn't sign that pledge and didn't remain neutral on issues.
Well, when we're talking about journalists, it does get sort of particularized because of the nature of what journalists mm-hmm. do. If you read... for example, I've looked at the New York Times' code of ethics for its reporting staff, and it is very mm-hmm. almost draconian rules about how you cannot express your opinions. You can't even put a political yard sign in your yard, because at all times your neighbors know you work for the Times and may think that this is an opinion. And if you're a journalist who's not a journalist doing commentary, I think that's a legitimate concern about the ethics of journalism. I do believe that, like other employers, some newspapers or media organizations go overboard, sweeping a little bit more broadly than necessary. There was a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle who was fired a few years ago. He was a tech reporter. He reported on, you know, new gadgets and devices and computers. And on the weekend, he went to an anti-Iraq war rally, and they figured it out and fired him. And I think that may be sweeping a little bit too yeah. broadly. Obviously, the Don Imus case comes to mind right. when you talk about on-air talent.
Right, and we almost are out of time, and I want to give yeah. you one. What do you hope changes, or are you just warning us?
No, I spend the last part of the book saying how I think we could improve things. We don't have time to go into the details, but it falls into two categories. I think there are some tweaks to the law that we could make. Some states have some protections. I wish other states would mimic them. But also, I argue for a change in how managers and executives and employers think about their role in all of this. Mm-hmm. Think about themselves not just as servants to this labor market exchange, this labor market economy, but yeah. think of themselves with employees, with society, as part of a larger system yeah. Upon which the health of our democracy rests.
We will think about it. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Bruce Barry, author of Speechless. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.